It was curiosity about meditation that first drew me in through the doors of a retreat, which was actually in Nepal in 1990, and I've been a committed meditator ever since. I had a long and rather cautious journey through, well, I'm meditating in a Buddhist context to, oh, I'm interested in Buddhism, or, wow, quite a lot of Buddhism seems to make a lot of sense. And then finally, actually, in fact, here, I remember being sort of spurred by just having a huge wave of gratitude to Tariloka, to having this context. It was after the my second child, and I just felt so much gratitude that I could come here and have the nourishment and respite that I had here. And that spurred me to then ask to be ordained as a Buddhist. And then even within that process, I became more aware of a really clear orientation towards awakening, enlightenment, waking up. And specifically, I remember at one point, I think at Tiruvannamalai, to stream entry within this lifetime. So that's a summary of how I got here. But 20 years of that has been in the context of motherhood, as well as work and other contexts. But it's motherhood, obviously, that I'll focus on here. So the orientation of this talk is about being on a spiritual path towards awakening whilst raising children. It's about the perfection of wisdom and compassion and how motherhood presents us with particular gifts and challenges. So I want to provide some pointers as to how we can recognise and embrace the gifts and turn towards the challenges in ways that are conducive to wisdom and to compassion. I'm not saying that raising children is either better or worse than any other context for spiritual practice, and I'm not sentimental about motherhood, but we all have children, or at least nearly all of us, and one will soon. So that makes it important to talk about. So I'm aware that you're all here, you know, for different reasons. Some see yourselves as Buddhist and on a spiritual path, and others not, and that you have a range of experience and different motivations. Perhaps some of you are mostly looking for a modicum of calm or to be able to ground yourselves a bit amidst the demands of raising children, among all the other things you do. Or maybe hope that meditation and Buddhism can help you become a better parent in some way. So any motivation to practice is good. For me these days, the momentum to practice is more clearly fueled by knowing that the more that I wake up, the more use I can be to those around me, and that includes my children. But for many years, particularly when they were small, I practiced mainly because I thought I'd go mad if I didn't, or at least sort of lose perspective, lose positive values. I mostly had sort of little other aspiration than survival. And I'd only become aware that actually I had moved on and shifts had taken place. I'd only become aware of that when I went away on retreat and had the space to reflect and notice, which for most of the time my children was growing up was about once a year that I'd go on retreat. But now I don't know how I would be without Buddhism and meditation, and I still feel immense gratitude. So whatever brought you here, I really hope and believe that you'll benefit from this weekend and your ongoing practice. So I want to launch in by taking you back to a moment in time when my children were about 6 or 8. And those of you that have read the book that I wrote will recognise, which I know Jessie and Ellen and a couple of other people were saying last night that they had. So this is a scene taken back, so they're about 6 and 8. And it was about 9 o'clock one night, and I was standing by the kettle, waiting for it to boil, and very, very tired. So I'm standing there very, very tired and feeling really quite low with the tiredness, having spent the evening delousing the children again. And the thoughts arising in my mind as I'm waiting for the kettle to boil are about that Greek god, you know, who's sentenced to an eternity of pushing a boulder uphill, and then it gets to the top and it rolls back down again, you know. So every time I'm about to break the breeding cycle of a common head louse, you know, the kids rest their heads against, you know, another child at school, or go to their dad's where they didn't really get combed, and then it'd be sort of back again and we'd have another infestation. So as I'm standing there at the kettle, it's this sense of it's never ending. It's grindingly repetitive. It's never going to end. And except, of course, that it isn't. You know, and even as I stood there, there was a sense of just something very small just releasing or dropping. And with that arising a greater lightness. And actually the thoughts that then arose were things like, you know, actually my son, you know, used to have these tight blonde curls, and then, you know, then he had sort of, at the time I was having this happening, he had straight brown hair. You know, my daughter was sort of started to comb half of her hair whilst I combed the other half. And also I was aware that, you know, whilst I comb their hair, I'm talking about, oh, you know, nice, like, nice, clean hair, you know, which was exactly what my mother used to do when she deloused us when we were children, because it was destigmatizing the whole thing of having lice. And it's quite likely that her mother used to do that for her too. So by the time the kettle boiled, which was obviously not long, I wasn't quite sort of laughing out loud to myself, because that would have been a bit mad. But that glimpse, you know, that moment of insight into reality, which is what it was, released me from being completely absorbed in and overwhelmed by what I'd seen as this fixed, stuck situation. And I could suddenly see it more clearly for what it was, which was just simply the momentary coming together of a number of changing conditions. So you will all probably have had, or certainly will have, similar glimpses or insights where we can see directly the impermanent and insubstantial nature of all experience. And it is helpful to recognise them for what they are and for what they point to. And the context of motherhood can be really fertile ground. And it's not only because children change more quickly and more obviously than adults, but they do. You know, we're living with a lesson in impermanence at our feet, so to speak. So within that, I just want to take... So impermanent, in a way, is fairly easy to get your head round conceptually. You know, you can sort of see it. You know, we watch trees change into autumn and leaves fall, and we can sort of get that conceptually. But I just want to take a moment to unpick insubstantial. As Buddhism talks about all of experience being impermanent and insubstantial. So, and unsatisfactory. So that's the three lakshanas, the three marks of conditioned existence, for those of you who have looked at that. But so to unpick insubstantial, I want to use an example, and I'm going to use the example of a child's birthday party. So if you refer to, say, Max's fifth birthday party, you know exactly what you mean, talking about Max's fifth birthday party. And we all do. We all know what you're referring to. It's a really convenient label, and it means that we can all talk about Max's fifth birthday party. But what exactly is it? So when you look at the conditions that make up Max's fifth birthday party, there's got where it's held, you know, is it at home or in a hall somewhere, what's the theme, any entertainment you've got laid on, obviously it needs lots of friends to come, or at least some friends to come, you know, you've got his excitement, you've got birthday cake, you've got party food. And then there's also the important condition of him it being 5 years since he was born, and all the conditions that preceded that, leading to his conception and birth. So all of these conditions come together in a moment in time to create that which we label as Max's fifth birthday party. But at, say, 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock, it no longer exists. Max's fifth birthday party no longer exists. The conditions have ceased, and with it, the party. So when we look, the party itself is insubstantial. There's no enduring substance. that continues or can be identified. You've just got some rather overtired children, overstimulated with sugar. So, and that is a direct example, a direct experience of the insubstantial nature of experience. Yep, something which we label, and when you look, it's all these coming together, changing conditions, no fixed and enduring substance. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's the nature of everything, including ourselves. This coming together, flow, change, no substance, no permanence. Paticca-samuppada is the term, again, for those of you who are familiar with that. So everything coming into being, independence on conditions, and when those conditions cease, it ceases. Essence of Buddhism. And that would be fine if we could see that clearly at all levels and be fine with it. But on the whole, we don't. Even though it's sort of relatively easy to acknowledge cognitively that nothing lasts forever, our responses show us that we're far from on board with it. We try to fix things, hold things, ascribe them a substance and a permanence that they don't have, and get upset or cross when they prove to be insubstantial. We can then end up separating ourselves from what we don't like and sort of barricading ourselves in, trying to feel safe, trying to keep the threats out. And that's what makes experience unsatisfactory, which is the first and second of the four noble truths, you know, that suffering exists and that there is a cause of suffering. That is the cause of it. But as Buddhism teaches us, we can change that. So as we wake up to this changing flow of conditions, we align ourselves with it gradually, and gradually stop sort of metaphorically swimming upstream, beating our heads against a wall, wanting things to be other than they are. So even without the perspective of waking up in a Buddhist context and that being the aspiration, it's not hard to see how this process can simply make life easier and more enjoyable for us and those around us. So the alternative's not that great. It's constantly wanting things to be other than they are. But within this process, so we can't make insights into the nature of things happen. We can't make them happen. But we can set up conditions to make them more likely, as well as recognize and learn from those glimpses that we do have. And so one of those conditions is mindfulness and building our mindfulness. And we can only do that through practice, basically. So practice both in terms of on the cushion, if we have a meditation practice, but also off the cushion as well, in terms of being able to develop that sort of sense of being able to focus, sensitive to whatever's arising in the moment through the senses. So we're not just inhabiting the world of sort of concepts and interpretation. And Amrita is going to help us look at this a bit more in the workshop after the tea break. And we can also set up reminders for ourselves in terms of being mindful. So much about mindfulness is simply remembering to be mindful, to catch ourselves when we're sort of lost in thought and coming back to the direct experience of what's actually happening now. And in Buddhism, remembering that does include awareness just of thoughts arising. The mind is a sixth sense in Buddhism, so thoughts arising is part of our direct experience of the moment. And we don't have to shut out thoughts. We haven't failed to be mindful because we've got thoughts arising. So at that moment, by the kettle, I had actually set up some of the conditions that do support those glimpses. So by the kettle, for example, I had strategically placed some photographs I'd taken one summer evening in Highgate Woods, which were at a moment when I was feeling very grounded and feet on the ground and earth and smelling earth and in contact with nature. And they were there to remind me that actually when the kettle was boiling, it was a reminder for me to just stand there, feel my feet on the floor, and wait for the, you know, just to stand there basically as the kettle boiled, you know, rather than distract myself or eat from all the nice little jars of nuts and raisins that I had around the kettle. So that thing about coming back to ourselves, to the breath, to our feet on the ground, is something we can do whenever the opportunity arises. It needn't take long. You know, it's not about necessarily carving out huge amounts of time that probably none of you have. And it can often be done whilst, without actually stopping what we're doing. So it might be whilst we're waiting for something, or sometimes you get that thing with small children where, you know, it's very full on and you're doing and doing, doing stuff, maybe down on the ground playing with them. But then spontaneously there's a moment where they're happily absorbed on their own or with each other, and you can simply sit and bring attention back. Back to yourself, back to your body, back to whatever's arising, whilst that window's arisen naturally. So you may be able to recall, I mean, I know I can, moments with my children, with that when they were younger, that stand out in my memory with a real intensity. And that's because of the attention I gave to that moment in time as it was happening, and that they still sort of stand out in my memory as very intense. There were times when I was just turning my attention to what was arising. And I had an example of this, in fact, last week with my son, because he's moved out. And he rang me up, I think, last week or the week before, to tell me that he'd stopped smoking marijuana, which wasn't the first time, but, and that he was needed challenges and stuff to do because... you know, just to occupy him, and he was sort of thinking ahead to life post stoned. whilst I was sort of sitting there on the phone to him, I did do that thing of just turning my attention to what was arising. And first of all, what was arising was this desperate sort of grasping at it. You know, what he was saying, I wanted to sort of fix it and hold it and make it real and make it enduring and make it all better and supply what he needed. So then I sort of turned more towards my breath and sort of just physically sat back, actually, I think, you know, because I was sort of on the edge of my seat, really. And then felt much more just, I was just allowing myself to enjoy the moment. It's like, oh, nice moment. You know? And that also then prevented me from intervening and taking over and taking responsibility away from him. It was easier for me to say, oh, that's interesting, you know, what's worked for you last time, da, da, da. And that was so easy to take over. And actually it points to another great opportunity for practice, which is where we love intensely, but we have to sometimes hold quite lightly. And I'm going to come back to that one in a minute. So often when I'm talking with mothers about this whole topic about practice in the context of motherhood, the main thing that seems to come back is that people confess that they lost their temper, or they yelled at their children and then are sort of feeling really bad about it. And also that seems to sometimes precipitate people doubting the effectiveness of anything that they're doing. It's like, oh, I've done all this meditation and then I yelled at the kids. And so one of the things that I wanted to sort of emphasise, built on that, is one of the gifts of motherhood as a context for spiritual practice is that it helps us to experience a really broad range of human emotions, from really sort of overwhelming, exquisite, open-hearted love right through to sort of near murderous rage. Yeah, and too often I think in our society, people can live within quite a narrow range of what it is to be human. You know, maybe between how are you? Oh, fine, not great. You know, it's quite a narrow range, and there's actually quite a lot of social pressure to inhabit that range. And sometimes you can feel a bit like a weirdo or self-conscious if you're expressing either the really intense joy and love, or, you know, feel really fearful of expressing or even feeling anger and rage. And we can also actually feel quite anxious about experiencing joy quite often, because then there's that sort of anxiety that comes up that it's not going to last, that we can't hold it. So this has a further danger that we sort of avoid or bypass or squash down strong emotions. So sometimes people can end up not even knowing what their experience is. And sometimes that means it just erupts in quite harmful ways or quite stressful ways. And in fact, on a course that Sharon and I were doing at the North London Buddhist Centre recently, somebody gave a really nice little talk on truthful speech, the precept of truthful speech, and focusing very much on the need to know yourself in order to speak authentically, that you can't be authentic unless you actually know what's going on. So being aware of emotions as they arise shows them to us and enables us to witness how they change and pass. So we can experience emotions as sensations, feelings in the body. And maybe that can also help point to the fact that those are impermanent too. Impermanent, insubstantial, and ultimately unsatisfactory. So even the good ones. So experiencing them for what they are makes them less scary and more manageable, and can maybe also open up some space around them, which can have the added benefit that we might be able to dwell in the gap between something arising and us acting on it, even when that's quite intense and even when the gap is very, very tiny. But mostly it's really important. What's really important is getting to know what it is to be this human being more fully. And that, with that, we can also dispel some of the illusions that we maybe hold about ourselves and be more real, basically. So if I just inhabited the working world, I would probably find it quite easy to delude myself that I'm reasonably emotionally level and balanced and calm. But because of that, I've learned to appreciate that my children press buttons that no one else has yet identified, whether they're 20 months or 20 years old. So it's really just an encouragement to embrace and appreciate that reality that we do inhabit quite a wide range of human emotions through the context of being mothers, because there are so many benefits to that. So another gift inherent in being a mother is the gift of not getting what you want. So of people, so our children at least, simply refusing to do or to turn out how we want them to. So I was particularly blessed with this gift from my son. So from almost the moment he turned 13 until he was 20, which was just last month. And for those of you who read the book that I wrote, he was 12 when that was published. So I'm aware that I still drew on him quite a lot, because he had offered a lot more material than my relatively angelic and wonderful daughter. He's wonderful too, but still. But there's a danger that I don't stop talking about him once I start. And in fact, there's a relatively new friend of mine in the order who admitted she used to think of me as Karen Agita, that's the one with a difficult son, you know, so I have to be a bit careful. So I'm just going to hone in on one particular phase of time, which was when he was just coming up to GCSEs, and he was in school less than half the time, and I was sort of frequently called into the school to be told this and dire consequences threatened. And when this would happen, I'd summon his father, and I was supported by a really excellent tutor, Jihad, and we'd meet up, we'd all talk about the importance of it, and we'd persuade him to attend school, so we thought. And then, you know, I'd get him up in the morning, which was a huge act of will, and I'd get him out of the door on time, had breakfast, all the right books in the bag on his back, go to work, completely exhausted. Oh, I've done it, made it, you know, I've achieved what I need to for the day. And then the school would call an hour later and say that he hadn't turned up. And so in that period of time, there were times when I would sit in meditation and it felt like all of my body wanted to scream. I was just pushing against it. I did not want this reality. I wanted a different one. I wanted a different one where my son went to school. I wanted things to be other than they were, and I wanted to make him do something that in reality I was powerless to do. I mean, that was what was happening. Whether if I'd had better skills at the time, I would have been able to. But whenever you go into would have, could have, should have, you're arguing with reality. The reality was that I was doing my best with the skills and context I had at that moment in time, and he wasn't in school. And gradually through that, sitting with this intensity of sensations, I learned to sort of allow that to arise in the body, to turn towards them, to simply experience them. What does it feel like when the whole of your body wants to scream and push against the reality that's happening? I'm sure you will have all have felt it, so you'll know. And, you know, I mean, I couldn't always do it, and I found a lot of that time difficult. But I think the fact that I did have a practice, a spiritual practice, both, you know, on the cushion and off, and created that habit of turning towards feelings and allowing them to rise, and then noticing them, the rise, change and pass, took some of the heat out of it, and it made it easier to have some form of perspective and actually maintain communication and connection with him. So it didn't solve the get to school thing, but you know, but you know, later that came to a head for me when I was here actually a couple of years ago. And I was supporting a retreat, and by that time he'd moved to Brighton and was failing to attend college there too. And I was here and having similar phone calls from his tutor. And so I decided at one point that I was going to leave here. I mean, I couldn't leave for long because I was supporting Dhammagita on an arts retreat and I was needed. But I decided to leave for the day, booked a taxi to pick me up at 5:30 in the morning to get the train back, get him back into college and come back again, all within a day. And then I spent this totally unbearable night lying awake, and it was like most of me, it was all the sort of motherhood buttons being pressed, and most of me was sort of screaming, I just want to kiss it better, I just want to make it better, I want to make it all right for him. But there was also this growing gradual part of me that was starting to accept the reality that I couldn't, and that actually rushing back to save him at that particular moment in time was not the most helpful thing for him in the long run, that I had to let him fail. So I got up and I cancelled the taxi and I stayed on the retreat. And it did feel completely unbearable, and I was in floods of tears, so it was fortunate that Dhammagita is one of my best friends and was here and very supportive. But I stayed. He got himself back to college that week. And it wasn't for another couple of weeks that he was thrown out. But when I was at the Buddhist Centre a few weeks ago, I noticed a thought arise, which was along the lines of, who would I be if it wasn't for Jai? Accompanied by gratitude. So he's given me the grit I needed to live firsthand the fact that we're not in control. We cannot control life. Life is king. And children really can be our best friends in that way, over and over again. So that moment on the retreat here changed my life. It was a lasting lesson for me in loving and letting go, in accepting things or accepting him as he was, rather than beating my head against that metaphorical brick wall. So it was a lesson in acceptance, equanimity, and letting go. Most of all, letting go of him, all of which are vital in a spiritual life, and all of which we have many opportunities to practice within motherhood. So since that time, my life got lots easier because my anxiety levels plummeted. And I do also believe it's been really good for him too, and he's actually growing up. So growth in wisdom and compassion is not inevitable simply because we're mothers. It's what we make of the context and the perspective we have, and such simple things as just coming back to our breath, our feet on the floor, to the present moment, with all its complexity and sensations. So I want to talk a bit about one of the greatest gifts of motherhood, heart opening. So that's a real heart opening love, which is either conducive to growth or can cause us to really close down, protect ourselves, protect those that we love from harm. So that sense of sealing off, shutting out a frightening world, which can then separate us and prevent us experiencing directly this reality that we are all interconnected. And, you know, within that as well, I think one of the things I notice can arise is, for me, is pride. So, for example, when I hear people saying how difficult it is with their teenage daughters, sometimes there's a smugness in my response that arises. And that, with that, you know, that smugness, oh, well, mine's all right, you know. And that in itself closes down. That's what it conduces to, is anything that sort of closes down. But having children can offer an opportunity to experience otherwise sort of unknown levels of heart opening and love. And so other moments where I'm feeling calm, grounded and more positive rather than sort of fearful and contracted, that's when it gives rise to more empathy and compassion in response. So then when a friend's telling me about their teenager with mental health problems, or I'm hearing of mothers the other side of their world sort of unable to give their children the basics they need to survive, let alone thrive, that connection, that being a mother, taps into an empathy and connection. So having children can be a very natural connection with a wide range of people simply because it's a very widespread shared experience and gives an instant connection and a way in that we can build on. So even coming here, you know, sometimes it's very hard. You come, there's 25 people, you've never seen any of them before, for most of you. There's a natural way in, there's a natural connection. We're all mothers, or very soon about to be. And so also that can result in feeling the sense of mudita, of sympathetic joy. That's what arises when an open heart meets good news, you know, when our friends' children do well. And even you can notice sometimes if you're tuning into what's arising in your experience, things can coexist. There might be that sense of very natural response of mudita, of sympathetic joy, alongside thoughts that are more envious. And that's fine. We're just turning towards and being aware of what's arising. So then it makes it easier to respond with a sort of a patience and a lightness. So a thought, an envious thought arising, is simply an expression of our conditioning. Oh well, you know, who knows where it came from? You know, it's just there. It just arises, it passes. And we don't need to invest it with any more power than it has. We don't need to hold on to it and think, oh, I'm a terrible person because this thought arose. It just arises, it passes. It's an expression of our conditioning. So like so much else in this context, the experience of love can be a way to open our hearts further and to connect when it's seen within a wider perspective. So that's one of the many reasons why it's helpful to hold that perspective of being a being on a spiritual path, whatever that means to you at this particular moment. So finally, really. So although the teenage years present their own special brand of things to turn towards, I'm aware that I do have a luxury of time that many of you parenting small children may only dream about. So I wanted to just conclude with some practical pointers to building our ability to be mindful, recognising our shared humanity and connectedness, and allowing the conditions for insight to arise, or making more likely moments of calm and sanity, if that's where your attention lies now. And we're also going to have groups this afternoon and tomorrow, so you can explore your own particular context and experience, and we can look at sort of what's helpful within those as well. But just a few pointers to conclude with. So one is to sort of set up reminders for ourselves to bring us back to mindfulness of our direct experience in the moment. You know, like I had the photos by, I have the photos by the kettle, but you can have, you know, quotes on the fridge or mindfulness bells set up on an app during the day. Whatever it is that will remind you to just, I'm like, oh right, okay. Feel your feet on the floor, breath, what's arising. And then having a daily or regular meditation practice is invaluable in terms of supporting access to mindfulness at other moments. Not essential, but very helpful. But as we're emphasising, we will emphasise during the meditations here, and did a bit this morning, you don't have to have complete silence or even necessarily uninterrupted time to meditate. So my approach when the kids were small was to have the door open or ajar when I was meditating, and they knew they could come in and sit with me. And obviously they have to be old enough to be able to be left in the house, you know, left in another room unsupervised. But after a few times of them coming in and finding it really extremely boring, they just found something more interesting to do whilst I meditated. And then there's also just making the most of the opportunities for space and nourishment that do arise. You know, whether that's really relishing being in the shower and there's no children there at all, or, you know, or being out in the open air. And, you know, like being in the woods, nourished by green. I often used to, you know, just go outside, basically. It was really, really helpful in terms of just feeling sane and grounded. You know, and I still spend a lot of time going up onto Hampstead Heath because of living in London. But even there's something about even, yeah, children playing outside that seemed to be conducive to that sense of spaciousness. And other people are really, really important. And preferably, you know, like Francesca, I think, was saying yesterday on the, when we went round about, you know, having friends that are mothers and friends who are Buddhists and wanting to have some that are both, you know, you were saying, weren't you, that, you know, so it is, you know, if we can share our orientation on the spiritual life with other friends, then that's great. But also just to have people that we can share the childcare and life with. So also, I've got here recognizing that life is full and that there's lots to do, and just being mindful of the thoughts that arise in relation to that and which thoughts we feed. You know, for example, do we have a constant story arising of it's all terrible, I feel overwhelmed, it's unbearable, I can't cope, which used to arise a lot with me. And or, you know, that, wow, there's a lot to do. I'm not going to achieve it all. I'm just doing what I'm doing now. You know, for example, it's quite interesting just to notice the thoughts that arise and which ones we feed and which ones we don't. That can be immensely helpful. And finally, just developing that habit of turning towards difficult experiences and feelings with an air. And curiosity is a very useful concept and practice within this. So you're turning towards it with a, oh, wow, what's going on here? You know, curiosity is nearly always accessible. Equanimity isn't always accessible, but curiosity can be. So it's just turning towards it, and just like I was explaining when I was wanting to sort of scream and push away the experiences arising in me because of Jai. So having faith, really, that although we may not experience any benefit immediately, it's not that we turn towards those feelings and say they subside or show their insubstantiality. More often than not, they don't. But having faith that actually doing that and dwelling in and experiencing that gap between feeling and acting will have an effect. You know, you don't have to take it on faith because I'm sitting here saying it, but that's something to explore in your direct experience that can then build the confidence in it. So I am immensely grateful that I'm Buddhist and for all that is inherent within that. So I've got an adult lifetime now of meditation, deep and valued friendships, and waking up to the way things are, leading to greater equanimity, less conflict, and so much more. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to share this with you, get to know you a bit, and for us to be able to offer what we can this weekend. So really, really delighted that you all made it here. Thank you. So we've got an opportunity now for questions, if anyone wants to, and I'll open those up if Amrugita and Sirigupta are also welcome to, willing to respond. Francesca.
Thanks so much for being so open about your son, that was really inspiring. But I think we could all probably relate to this. What do you do with guilt? Because is it just a massive unskillful, you know, it's just one massive unskillful thought, but it's pretty uniquely present one, I think, within motherhood. So do you just strategies for getting through those moments?
The workshop that we're doing afterwards,
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
That's a short answer, but anything.
Yeah. I mean, I just find guilt really, really fascinating. And actually, well, the thought that arose when you said that was my father. When I was raised Catholic. My dad was very Catholic, and but when I got divorced, and my dad came up to sort of talk to me about it. I mean, and we went out to supper together, and we didn't do much one-to-one time. And I remember saying at one point, I felt guilty, you know, because the children, he said, bah, unhelpful Catholic stuff, guilt, you don't want to be doing with that. So there you go. But it's, it is fascinating, and I think it's really useful to separate out between remorse and guilt. Because, remorse, in from a Buddhist perspective, is a positive mental state. And guilt is unhelpful. So I think it's perfectly fine to think, I don't want to do that next time, and learn from things. And when the thoughts just keep arising, just you can literally just come back to the body, come back to sensations. Oh, there's that guilt thought again. Come back to sensations. Oh, there's that guilt thought again. Come back to sensations. Because it simply isn't worth feeding, investing, giving it more energy.
Because the reason why that is, because the thing about guilt is that it keeps us stuck in terms of not actually changing the conditions or the thing that we're upset about, you know, or that we think we've done wrong. Mm-hmm. Guilt somehow keeps us sort of in a kind of powerless position. Mm-hmm. Where we don't actually see the capacity to change. There's remorse when we kind of recognise and become aware of the consequence of our actions. And we have a real intention to change that, it can actually move us forward because it's not repetitive in the same way that guilt is.
How do you mindfully discipline a very willful 3.5-year-old that does not listen and stay on the naughty state where she should be? Sometimes I'm there for kind of 48 minutes, I think has been the longest, and outwardly it's all fine and she is not getting to me, and then I put her to bed and I just go in the garden. Yeah. And then come back. Is it just keep doing that?
Sounds like you could teach me more than I could teach you about disciplining a willful 3.5-year-old. And I think that, that thing about you cope and then you feel a huge emotion, I can't see anything wrong with that. You know, and I think quite often in life when we're sort of raising children, you get these moments where you think, I can't bear it, I can't cope. Mm. But it's almost like, well, what's the alternative? Yeah. Am I going to literally explode, literally implode, And I think that process in of itself is... those moments where I can't bear it, I can't cope, it's all unbearable, they mature us. You know, that it is one of the massive gifts of motherhood, is that we do grow up massively. You know, we really, really, really have to. And there's nothing wrong with screaming in the garden at 7 o'clock at night when the child is asleep, in my view, but I don't know if anyone's got anything more directly.
I think it's what you said as well in your talk, that you have those responses that you need to express how frustrating the situation has been, which is what you're doing, and that we do need those sort of outlets like that.
Okay.
At the same time, there's the opportunity to just acknowledge that it's not, you know, things are not going the way you want them to be, and you can't control things. So I think bringing that sort of perspective in as well helps. Because sometimes we can just get at loggerheads, and it's like your will against their will.
I just say I'm not arguing with you, darling.
That's very calm response. and yet inside,
I just think.
But inside, you might sometimes I say that as well. But inside, I'm like, you will do what I want you to do. And I think it's just allowing that space as well to think, okay, yeah, things are not the way I want them to be, and sometimes it's like that.
And then you have to have strategies. Feeding to.
Where
is my husband? Why is he in the hammock in the garden when I am bathing them again?
Going back to the first point, I was struck by your description of when you were on the phone and you said you actually sort of sat back, you know, to give yourself a bit of space, and I thought that sounded quite an interesting way of trying, because it is that sort of like, what do you do in that moment when, you know, to try and give yourself a space, because it's happening so fast as well, you know, and it's really easy to react with a harsh word or, you know, whatever. I just thought that was a really useful tip, so like
literally
somehow
sit back,
do some kind of bodily thing to give yourself a bit of space.
If my daughter's really been 2.5 fully, and I'm feeling quite closed down, if I can feel it happening to me, I literally just walk away, so that, because all that's going to happen is I'm going to get really, really stressed out. But what I've started actually doing is making a threat with an immediate consequence that I'm going to have to follow through. So she sees a direct consequence straight away that she's not going to like. So that, to try and get an immediate, so there's like an immediate sense of, right, I didn't do what I was meant to do here, and now there's this. And by making that and sort of putting myself in a contract of that and having to follow it through straight away, so she sees it straight away, you get the tantrum and everything in the moment, but you kind of, I feel like I'm setting up the groundwork when I'm a bit calmer and she's a bit calmer, and we can sort of move on with it. I don't know if that makes sense. Like running across the road the other night on the way home, and it's like, you're wearing the reins tomorrow. And that's it, and she's enraged and she hates it, and that's it. So this is just, we're not going, do you know what I mean? Or if you do this, then just doing that. But if they're not cooperating with something that's meant to be, this is a consequence, and it's not working, then, right, if not this, then that, and then straight away that happens, it gives you a kind of bit of space around it as well, because you've set the groundwork before you get angrier, I think. Does that make sense?
There's some interesting tips and some things I didn't love, but in a book called The Buddha Had Kids. Do you know that book?
Mm-hmm.
No? Mm-hmm. I picked it up at the Buddhist Center in Cambridge. It's actually quite good, because it's a lot of anecdotal stories and tricks that you can use. Okay. You know, very practical for those moments. And I think one thing I've tried to do is like pick a trick a week. You know, like try something different for a week, and if it works, then you can kind of, but you know, with kids, you always have to be changing it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where if you can just keep it fresh for yourself, you might not get as, you know, bogged down by that same routine of punishment or consequence or whatever. But it's a good book, just to dip in and out
of.
If the Buddha Had Kids, I think it's called.
One of the things I used to love was having a job description, because it was just like, sorry folks, it's in the job description. It says here, you know, clause 3.4, you know, get them to keep bed, you know, get 6-year-old children into bed by 7:30. Sorry, it's in the job description. Blame that.